In 1992, director Spike Lee and star Denzel Washington gave the world a deep dive into the life of the Nation of Islam's most powerful voice.
In 2021, we take a return trip to the Speyside region of Scotland.
The film is Malcolm X.
The whiskey is the Macallan Double Cask 12-Year.
And we'll review them both. This is
the Film and Whiskey Podcast. Welcome to the Film and Whiskey Podcast, where each week we review a classic movie and a glass of whiskey. I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
And this week we are looking at the 1992 Spike Lee epic, Malcolm X. Brad, this is the first Spike Lee movie we've done since Do the Right Thing back in season two. It was not originally slated for this season. I watched it probably 6-8 months ago, and I was so floored, so blown away by this movie that I was like, you know what? We're calling an audible. We're going to throw this into season four because it was one of those movies that I felt like is underseen, is underappreciated, and I needed to talk about it with somebody. So here we are. I've been waiting for 8 months to have a conversation about this movie with someone. And finally, I have someone here to discuss it with.
I was going to say, we're really just getting back to the original concept for this podcast, that Bob just is desperate to talk about movies.
I need friends.
Carrie's just not having it. And so here I am.
Thank you for being my replacement wife.
You got it, man. No problem.
But yeah, man, here we are. We've watched this 3.5-hour epic movie. And I say the word epic, you know, I've said it twice already. I really do feel, Brad, like this movie cleanly fits into that mold of the epic film. And I think that's kind of a word that we use too much to describe movies, like anything that's big and action-packed gets slapped with the word epic. But when I think about epic films, you know, I think back to the movies of David Lean, like Lawrence of Arabia, that, you know, or Gone with the Wind. It's epic in scope. It's epic. You can see the cost of the movie on screen. It's usually a really long running time. And I think that this movie really fits right in with that, even though at its heart, it tells a pretty intimate story about one man's spiritual journey.
Well, I was actually going to say, Bob, we're starting off the podcast with a disagreement because for me, I actually don't really think that this fits the term epic in any way other than the length of the film. Like, when I call a film epic, I am thinking of, like, Lawrence of Arabia or Lord of the Rings or, you know, movies that really just span, I don't know, massive, huge concepts and locations and characters. And really, for me, this film felt like a small, intimate encounter with a man who, you know, was seen by the public in such specific ways that this felt like, honestly, just kind of a quiet, unobtrusive look into his life that I actually wouldn't call epic at all. Like, it feels like Malcolm X himself would not want the term epic to be used to describe his life.
Oh, I totally agree with that. I mean, I do think, though, you know, if we're going to start out disagreeing, like, I do think that the scenes where they go, you know, to Mecca and to Egypt and you see him riding the camel by the pyramids, like, it is all so reminiscent of Lawrence of Arabia, of movies like that. And clearly Spike Lee was leaning into some of that, right? But I don't know, man. I feel like even if it is a very small movie at its core, that this might be my favorite film by Spike Lee as a director. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know if it's as good as Do the Right Thing. But I think this is where Spike Lee, like, he's working within the confines of a biopic. He has to tell a story about a real person's life. He's working with a PG-13 rating. I think this is definitely his most Hollywood-feeling movie. Like, it just, it looks very cinematic. It doesn't have the crazy, like, Dutch angles going on that Do the Right Thing did. It seems very restrained in some ways for Spike Lee, who we know can be just, you know, crazy kinetic in his style of filming. And yet, like, I'm watching him just flex his muscle as a filmmaker with everything that he does with the camera in this movie. Brad, like, I think this movie is every bit as good as Do the Right Thing.
Honestly, I'm just kind of in a place where I feel like biopics, I don't know. I just feel like they have something of like a ceiling for how good that they can be. Like as I was watching this movie, it really didn't strike me as being very different than almost any other biopic I'd seen. And I guess when I look at these movies about historical figures, I feel like in the end, they can never be quite as dynamic as the person that they're trying to capture about how dynamic they were in real life. And, I think that's probably for a lot of reasons that, like, the directors usually are in awe of these people. That's why they choose to make a movie about them. But, like, to me, it just leads to a place where a lot of these biopics feel like they're walking on eggshells. They feel like they are... I don't know. I can't quite put fully into words.
It feels
words.
Like they're playing it safe, doesn't it?
Yeah, and honestly, like, there were parts of this movie where I kind of felt that way, and not necessarily with, like, what they revealed about his life, but with the camera work, with the music, with the way the movie was made. It just felt like a safe foray that you don't see him doing with something like Do the Right Thing.
I have a lot of thoughts based on what you said, Brad, and we are going to get into explaining the movie here in just a minute. But I think back to a couple of the biopics that we've done on this podcast, and the complaints that I hear you making now are complaints that we had, especially with a movie like Bohemian Rhapsody, which we thought was just a terrible movie, and I would continue to contest that it's a terrible movie.
Oh, hey, Bob, I just want to let you know, Bohemian Rhapsody is a terrible movie.
It's a terrible movie, Brad.
It's really terrible.
It's so bad. But, you know... For a person who liked to live on the edge as much as Freddie Mercury, to have such a safe biopic made about him, we really thought was a travesty. And I think the way that you break out of the mold or the tendency to play it safe is through the filmmaking technique, right? Because if I had to compare this movie to any other biopic that we've done on this podcast, I'd compare it to The Aviator. I think that it is really, really similar to The Aviator in a lot of ways. You know, it's about a figure who had like this huge historical backdrop going on around them. With Howard Hughes, it's, you know, the early years of Hollywood. With Malcolm X, it's the rise of the Nation of Islam and the civil rights movement. And what Spike Lee and Martin Scorsese both do is they work within the confines of that genre, but it is like undeniably a Scorsese movie and undeniably a Spike Lee movie. Like the way he moves the camera, the way that he edits in between scenes, and the crazy whip pans that you'll see when people are shouting from one end of the room to the other. And, you know, like later on in the movie, when Malcolm X's house gets a Molotov cocktail thrown through the window, they're intercutting that back with what Malcolm X saw as a child. And you're spanning, you know, 30 something years there. It's just like all of Spike Lee's bag of tricks are employed in this movie. And I think what I love so much about it is that I've seen Spike Lee bring his bag of tricks to other movies where it just doesn't work at all. It just seems like he's throwing things at the wall and nothing sticks. And in this movie, it's like, I feel like it's the best of both worlds, which is you get like a very focused Spike Lee, but he also gets to do the fun things that he likes to do behind the camera as well.
Yeah, Bob, I can tell that I'm going to have a hard time reeling you in on this episode because your feelings are at an 11 out of 10. So before we get so far down the road into what you love about this film, because I'm very fascinated to hear it all, how about we do Brad Explains?
Yeah, you are just the worst, man. All right, let's move into Brad Explains. This is the part of the podcast where Brad breaks down the plot of the movie that he has just seen, often for the first time. We know that that is the case today. Brad, as you know, we have implemented a 60-second time limit on Brad Explains this season. Can you explain the plot of this movie in under 1 minute?
Malcolm X is the story of a young man who believes firmly in justice. He, in his early life, is torn apart from his family. He follows his way into drugs, and in jail, he is introduced into the Nation of Islam. And soon after release, becomes one of its most prominent speakers. The movie follows his ability to open mosques and draw people into the nation simultaneously as he finds his wife and is married. And then it follows his disillusionment with the Nation of Islam and his formation of a new party of his own desire and making. And then he gets killed.
All right, Brad. So it sounds like you might be a little bit cooler on this movie than I am. And You know, that's to be expected, because I think that I'm coming in here as the guy that's going to be campaigning and crusading for this movie, because I do think it's underseen. I do think it kind of gets swallowed up by Do the Right Thing when we talk about Spike Lee. To me, like this, well, I'll get to my hotter takes later on in the episode. Let's hear from you, though. Like, what about this movie did you really like, and what about this movie just didn't do it for you?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm just being 100% blunt and honest, the movie was way too long, and it was just a little bit boring overall. Like I was drawn into the story, I was interested, but nothing about the film really made me fall in love with Malcolm or his family or, like, his vision. Like, it was just kind of pleasantly interesting. The problem is, based on what I've read of Malcolm X and what I've seen of, you know, his life and what he was striving towards, I don't know. He just felt like such a more explosive personality that I struggle with what to me felt like a really tame filmmaker, which is not something I would have expected from Spike Lee.
Interesting. So, of course, I disagree here, but I think that there are two ways to look at it. So this movie comes out in 92, right? Let's put this into historical context here. Spike Lee really becomes a household name with Do the Right Thing, right? Like, he was a pretty famous filmmaker before that. Do the Right Thing comes out, and it is like a cultural atom bomb went off. That movie only gets nominated for, I believe, 2 Academy Awards. I think Spike Lee gets nominated for Best Original Screenplay, and Danny Aiello got nominated for Best Supporting Actor, and that's it. And, you know, now we look back on that movie and we're like, man, the Academy was really scared to nominate that movie. And, you know, he makes 2 movies in the interim. So he makes a movie in 1990 and 1991. And this is like his big return to, I think, kind of chasing the Oscar at this point. And I do think there's a way to look at this movie, which is like Spike Lee has learned that making a big, explosive, confrontational movie like Do the Right Thing is not going to get his Oscar. And so he makes a more conventional, traditional style of a movie. I think that's like the more cynical way of looking at it. It might be true. I have no idea. But when I watch this movie, Brad, I really appreciate that the filmmaking is more traditional and is a little bit more restrained, because I think that if Spike Lee filmed this movie in the same style that he filmed Do the Right Thing, it would be too distracting from the message of the movie. Like, Malcolm X is such a polarizing figure and such a controversial figure in American history that I actually really appreciated that Spike Lee let the content of the movie be the sort of like controversial point of this movie, and that he wasn't competing against it with his really kinetic kind of filmmaking. I don't know. Does that make sense?
No, it totally does. And perhaps if I had watched this movie 5 years ago, maybe it would have had a deeper impact on me. But if the message of Malcolm X and what he says in this movie is supposed to be the controversial part of it, then maybe the last 5 years of U.S., y'all know what I'm talking about, has just kind of desensitized me to this message, where I'm like, yeah, dude thought that black supremacy was a thing, and that there was no reconciliation between white people and black people in America. And I'm like, yeah, that doesn't surprise me that he would think that.
Yeah.
Like that part of the message, I it doesn't bother me in any way. I'm like, oh yeah, I like, sure. That's a message. I understand why he's at that point.
So I have to stand here today as what I was when I was born, a black man. Before there was any such thing as a Republican or a Democrat, we were black. Before there was any such thing as a Mason or an Elk, we were black. Before there was any such thing as a Jew or a Christian, we were black people. In fact, before there was any such place as America, we were black. And after America has long passed from the scene, there will still be black people.
See, what I really like about the movie itself, though, is, you know, and I want to go in on this idea of it being too long, because it's a really long movie. And even watching it this time, I'm like, is this a flawless movie? No. But I had to really ask myself, all right, this movie is divided into 3 chunks. There's the chunk before he goes to prison. There is the chunk where he converts to Islam. He becomes Malcolm X. And then there's like the last, I'd say, 45 minutes of the movie where it all starts to unravel for him. And it's kind of set up, you know, and I don't mean to be crude here in my comparisons, but it kind of reminded me a lot of the structure of Goodfellas. Like, you got the young Henry Hill, the good times, and then the bad, and then the bad times at the end. And there's a lot of Goodfellas in this movie. Like, honestly, Spike Lee is doing so much with the way that he references other filmmakers. Early on in the scene where he's sitting up on the cliff and they're doing these little insert shots of the front of the car and what it looks like, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like a scene straight out of Goodfellas. Scorsese definitely had an influence on Spike Lee here. But what I love about the way the movie's structured, Brad, is that if you just look at it, you're like, why do we need all that stuff at the beginning before he goes to prison? But honestly, everything that they set up in that scene has a payoff later in the movie. And I actually really appreciated that we had this like extended introduction, because I feel like, as especially as two white guys, we only know, or we're only taught about Malcolm X as this figure, you know, in the Nation of Islam, who was very controversial and very confrontational. We don't see what got him to that point. And you see him, you know, as a person who completely lives for himself and becoming a person who is so totally committed to a cause that he's completely selfless about it. And ultimately, that's what leads to his downfall, because he completely trusts this figure, Elijah Muhammad, who ends up, you know, in many ways betraying him, shattering his faith. And then you get that last third of the movie where he really kind of digs down deep into, what do I believe? What was I kind of, for lack of a better term, brainwashed into thinking by this group of people, the hatred that was sown into me, and how am I learning to express my thoughts in a more loving way? And I think that's the thing that, especially as a white guy, that I really appreciate about this movie, is it presents Malcolm X as a person who is dynamic, who it is fluid in his thinking. He's constantly changing. He's constantly learning more things. And I think that so often we want to look at Malcolm X as a person who only believed the same thing his whole life. And so I really like that this movie lets us realize that that's not exactly how it was.
Well, I'm glad you pointed out like the structure of this, because really, if I had to break down how I feel about the movie, the first third of the film, when he is growing up and when he gets to Harlem and when he gets into the drug scene and the gang scene, I feel like that part of the film, and then the final part of the film, once he is disillusioned and moved on from the Nation of Islam, those are the two parts of the film that really drew me in and made me go, man, this is a really good movie. It really was that middle, I would almost call two-thirds of the film, that, because his time with the Nation of Islam takes up so much of the movie that, like, it was that entire part of the film that I just kind of felt bleh about. And honestly, like, we had the exact opposite experience with, like, 2001 A Space Odyssey, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we talked about the first part being really rough, and the ending is just weird as all get out. But that whole really extended middle sequence that could have been a movie on its own was really good.
Yeah.
And I think I'm literally in the exact opposite place here, where that middle part that felt like it could have been a movie on its own just was long and boring. And here's my problem with biopics. It was accurate. Like, I'm sure that that's the truth of his life, but a brainwashed character who is sucked into preaching a message that feels obviously wrong isn't a very exciting character to me. And I really struggled to have any empathy with him or care about him at all. It's when he was actually thinking for himself at the start and the end of the film that I was like, oh, this is a character that I can relate to.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand that. For me, I think that middle portion of the movie, you're right, Brad, it's a completely different style of movie. And I think, again, to Spike Lee's credit, he keeps this thing moving at a pace that I really appreciated, because I feel like with each of these kind of thirds, if we want to call them that, like, they each have a very different energy to them. The first third has that sort of like early Goodfellas, hey, these were the good times, into I'm going to prison. And the last third has this very suspenseful and I would say like operatic kind of feel. Like it has the weight of a tragedy, because he knows he's a marked man and he knows that his time is coming. And that middle portion is much more, I guess, like contemplative, meditative. Like, it deals with a lot of theological questions, which is not something you normally see in a Hollywood movie. And I think that's also partially why, you know, me as a theology major, I really love that they spent time taking this character's conversion seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the most beautiful things you saw about that conversion was his interaction with characters from the first part of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I think the most impactful and really just powerful scenes in the film is when he goes to see West Indian Archie years and years later, and he is just pretty much a cripple at this point. And when he sits there and helps him move his arm, like, that's the moment where you go, oh my gosh, like, this man has changed. His faith has really brought about a difference in him.
Yeah.
Like, that, for me, that was the most powerful scene in the movie.
All right. So let's go ahead and talk about the performances, Brad, because I do think this film, if nothing else, is full of great performances. We can't go any further without talking about Denzel. This is my second time watching this movie, Brad. Denzel Washington is one of my favorite actors in the world. And there's so many Denzel movies where he can get by being Denzel. You know, we've had this conversation about Tom Hanks that, you know, when Denzel shows up in Remember the Titans, he's just being Denzel Washington and it works. And you're like, man, what a great film. What a great performance. I think what you see here in Malcolm X is something completely different because not only does he have to, in some ways, impersonate a character or a real life person that we all know, we know his cadence and the way that Malcolm X spoke and his mannerisms, and he does all of that, but he still brings that incredible level of Denzelishness to it. Do you know what I mean? Like, he does this thing sometimes, and I noticed it like when he was doing his speeches out on the streets in Harlem, that when he's being real serious, he'll kind of like clench his jaw, or like he'll finish a sentence and then he'll like lock his jaw. And I'm like, oh, that's a Denzel-ism. Sometimes you just notice little things that actors do. And he gets to do all that in this movie. And he goes through such a range of like young innocence to completely crazy criminal to reformed person to, you know, the hunted at the end of the movie. And you watch this complete transformation of character, and yet at no point in the movie did I feel like, oh, Denzel's playing a completely different person now. The arc of the character of Malcolm X was so well played. I honestly think this is Denzel Washington's best performance ever.
Man, that I feel like is kind of a hot take.
Dude, I'm full of hot takes today. I love this movie, Brad.
Yeah, I can tell. I think Fences is probably one of his best performances.
Also a great movie. But that's a like, much more showy performance than this, too.
Oh, 100%. I mean, it is a Broadway show.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean? So I see what you're saying there. But for me, the performance in this movie is just Denzel being a really high-quality version of Denzel. I don't know. It just didn't blow me out of the water. I thought it was really great. I thought he was solid in his performance. He's eager when he needs to be eager. He's solemn when he needs to be solemn. And I guess if I had to say the best part of his performance is how believable he is at the start of the film and then in the transition to Islam. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely.
That, like, when he's in the prison cell with Brother Baines, who is leading him to Islam, and he gives his little speech about like not bending the knee to anyone, that like those moments are what make me go, oh man, Denzel's on top of his game in this movie.
Brad, you mentioned Albert Hall, who plays the character of Baines, who is, from what I can tell, not a real person. He's a composite character that kind of comprises this person that Malcolm X met in prison, who led him to Islam, and then who became kind of a right-hand man of Elijah Muhammad, who was the leader of the Nation of Islam.
All right, pull my coat on this now. What happens if you give all that up? I mean, the pork and you get sick and then you get a medical or something?
Like when I was on the outside, I ran this hustle. I tried to act like...
I'm telling you God's words, not no hustle. And I'm going to tell you, God is black.
God is black? Everybody knows God is white.
Everything the white man taught you, you accepted. He taught you were a black heathen and you believed him. He taught you to worship a blonde, blue-eyed Jesus with white skin, and you believed him. He taught you that black was a curse, and you believed that. Did you ever look up the word black in a dictionary?
For what?
Did you ever study anything that wasn't part of some con?
What the hell for, man?
I actually thought Albert Hall gave one of the best performances in this movie because he truly becomes just the worst. Like, he's a complete rat. And he, you know, he is a brown noser and he's doing the bidding of Elijah Muhammad and they are all conspiring against Malcolm X. And you watch his arc go from the person who is bringing Malcolm X to, you know, enlightenment to a person who is trying to cover up for all the terrible things that the nation is doing. And honestly, though, Brad, even though I think he has one of the best performances in the movie, I will say that, like, in contrast to Denzel, it actually took me a minute to make the connection that that was the same guy. Because when they show him after they get out of prison and he has those glasses on and he has kind of like a completely different demeanor and he's much more uptight, I'm like, who's that? And then he calls him Baines and I'm like, oh, that's the same guy from before. And, you know, while I think the actor did a great job, I think, once again, that just highlights even more for me how great Denzel was, that you didn't have that kind of dissonance, you know?
Yeah, there was definitely a sense of he was so important in the prison, but then Denzel so quickly usurps his role as like the most important member of the Nation of Islam that I would agree with you. If I think the beauty of his performance is that you can see for the rest of the film that whenever he says, well, you know, the brothers, the other ministers are complaining about Malcolm, you can feel the sense that he's the one that's like angry about it. And I'm sure others are as well, but he feels like the figurehead of that jealousy and anger, which, you know, contrasts with what he was trying to teach Malcolm at the very start of the film.
If I can jog your memory for a little bit, Brad, do you recall what other Albert Hall movie we've watched recently?
Bro, he was probably one of the few characters I actually liked in Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, we just saw him last week in Apocalypse Now. And here he is as Baines. And again, completely different characters, but what a fantastic actor.
I'm also going to just say, I'm a little bit offended, Bob. Like, you just treated me like a three-year-old. Like, now, son, do you know what else we saw him in? We just watched it last week.
Well, I mean, I do feel a little justified.
Sure you do. No, I love Albert Hall. I think he kind of reminds me of a more current actor that we've had in movies before. David Oyelowo from Interstellar and a few other movies. Like, there's something about the way he carries himself, Albert Hall, that, I don't know, those two actors just remind me of each other a ton.
One of the things I love about Spike Lee's movies is that, kind of similarly to Scorsese, he populates the smaller roles with people who don't have a lot to do and just kind of knock it out of the park anyway. And for me, like, that character in this movie is Delroy Lindo as West Indian Archie. Delroy Lindo is in a ton of Spike Lee movies. He was just the star this past year of The Five Bloods, which he should have gotten an Oscar nomination for. But watching him here, he doesn't have much to do. He's only in a few scenes. And then he comes back, you know, an hour later as a guy who is a stroke victim and completely convincingly plays that kind of, you know, physical handicap. I think Delroy Lindo is one of the best performances in this whole movie.
Dude, he knocked it out of the freaking park. Like, West Indian Archie, for me, the turmoil that you see in him as he raises up Malcolm as, you know, potentially his, like, heir apparent in this crime syndicate, to losing all of that over not wanting to pay out on a bet that they had made when they were all drunk and high. He just killed it for me. And you're right, Bob. I loved him in his role as West Indian Archie. And like I said, it's probably because when you see him as this victim of a stroke, you know, 10, 15 years down the road, and Denzel's tenderness with him in that moment, that's what allowed you to buy into Malcolm's conversion being like true and authentic, was that tenderness that he showed towards Archie. Mm-hmm. It was such a great scene.
All right, Brad, I'm going to give you another hot take before we run off into our whiskey segment
here. Hot take.
I don't think Angela Bassett's that good in this movie, dude. And, well, let me say this. I love Angela Bassett. I think she's a fantastic actress. I think that she does the best she can with some of the most horribly written dialogue I've ever heard. Do you know what I mean? Like, every time she has to call Malcolm dear heart, I'm just like, oh, man, like, she's trying, but even with her doing her best, I don't really think her character is given enough to work with here.
That's really interesting to me, Bob. I feel like for me, she brings a lot of grounding and like emotional core to this film, where I guess it just feels like in the middle part of the movie, when I'm just utterly bored with Malcolm and uninterested in who he is because he's just a puppet, she brings the energy of like actually caring for Malcolm for who he is, mm-hmm. and challenging his thoughts and challenging him and saying, no, like you need to be more than this. And so for me, I actually really enjoyed her performance. I agree that some of the dialogue was rough. I would imagine that they used those lines because they probably had letters from Malcolm to her that's what he called her. So I'm not sure if this is the problem with the biopic. If those lines are based on real life dialogue, then how are actors ever supposed to convey the heartfelt nature of a true real life romance? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think this kind of keeps getting us back to your central point here, Brad, which is that at least for you, biopics are just inherently limited in what they can do and what they can accomplish. And I think this one, for me at least, really does kind of transcend that mold the same way that The Aviator did. But we'll get into talking about all that in the second half of the episode. I want to go in a little more on what Spike Lee is doing here as a filmmaker. But before we get to any of that, let's hit pause. Let's head over to Scotland. And let's try this Macallan 12. What do you say?
I'll jump on my Learjet and meet you there.
All right, so today we are checking out the Macallan Double Cask 12-Year. Now, Brad, the Macallan is one of the most famous single malt scotch brands out there. In fact, like, they have so many different varieties of whiskey that they sell at so many different age statements that, you know, I would actually say this might be the definitive single malt scotch. I think the most expensive bottle of whiskey that ever sold was a Macallan. So we're really grateful to be sipping on this today. This is kind of their entry level. And this sample was sent to us by one of our Discord followers. Brad, I actually had to do some last minute scrambling because the 12-year Macallan actually has three different expressions. Again, this is just what Macallan does. There's a sherry wood expression. There's the one called the double cask. And then there's a triple cask. And I have been assured that what we're drinking today is their double cask, which was finished in two different kinds of ex-sherry barrels.
Yeah, honestly, if you live in Ohio, there's a wonderful website that is ohlq.com, and it'll tell you where any liquor that you want is in the state, how much it's going to cost. It's a great thing. But when I looked up Macallan on here, I mean, there was like 37 entries that I could have looked at, and I just got a little bit confused because there's a lot of freaking Macallans.
Yeah, there certainly are. So what we're drinking today is 43% alcohol or 86 proof, which seems to be kind of par for the course here with Speyside single malts. Again, if you want to hear more about what we think of the Speyside region or single malt scotches in general, just go back a few episodes to our Schindler's List episode where we did the Aberlour 16 and 18 year. But Brad, we're not here to talk about Aberlour. We're here to talk about the Macallan. What are you picking up on the nose here, man?
I threw this thing up, took a whiff, and it was pure honey, like just decadently sweet honey. There's a decent amount of like that malty kind of feel to it that is very specific to scotch. And then there's on the back end, I felt like I was getting a little bit of citrus paired in there. It's a really impressive nose. I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10.
All right. I'm going to give you like the single weirdest nosing note I've ever given on this podcast. Because I agree.
Funk.
I agree.
Funk, funk,
up,
funk.
Dude. Shut up. I agree with everything you're saying. Like, it is overwhelmingly sweet, but still, you know, definitely a scotch. Like, it's very barley heavy. But right when I was going to pull it away from my nose, I got this really strong, like, savory note to it. And I was like, what is that? I know that smell from somewhere.
Fried chicken.
It literally reminded me of like Campbell's vegetable soup that has like the little pieces of barley in it. Like it smelled like vegetable broth and barley. And I was like, where is this coming from?
But man, honey and chicken stock.
I'll tell you what, man, there's nothing better than vegetable broth and honey together. But seriously, overall, I really, really like this nose. I think it's a little more like aggressively sweet than the Aberlour was. And I'm sure that some people probably won't like that. Like it smells like it might be kind of a more inexpensive whiskey. You know, cause sometimes like cheaper whiskeys are just, it just smells like straight sugar as opposed to like more mature, complex notes. Honestly, I don't care because I don't really like space-eyed scotches that much. So I'm digging this, Brad. I'm also going to give this, I'll say an 8 out of 10 on the nose.
Yeah, and as I get into the flavor, it lets down a tiny bit. But overall, I mean, it is a incredibly smooth whiskey. You definitely get that honey coming through strong. Feels like there's some like dried fruits in there along with that bit of orange citrusy flavor that I was getting on the nose. Honestly, it's a really solid pour. I think that for me, the flavor just doesn't pack enough of a punch. Like it feels like it's missing a little bit of oomph to it that maybe a higher proof would help give it that. But, you know, it's still really solid. I'll give it a 7.5 out of 10 on the flavor.
What I really like about this is that it isn't taking on too much of the sherry character. You know, we get that sort of sherry note on lots of Irish whiskeys, lots of scotches. It doesn't have that kind of brininess to it. And I like that. It stays sweet. Lots of honey, very floral. Like it's very light, kind of bright whiskey on the palate. Right when you go to swallow, there's a lot of oak and it becomes a lot of grain. And almost for me, Brad, it almost reminded me more of a rye grain on the back end than it did barley. And then when I went to swallow, it was kind of like when you drink like a sparkling water or a mineral water. It had that kind of nice, refreshing, mouth-watering finish to it. I really like this. And again, I think I can kind of tell just by drinking it that it is a little bit of a cheaper whiskey than like the Aberlours were. And yet I actually enjoy this more. I think it's much more pleasant. It's much easier to drink. Like you said, I mean, the word smooth, it's a very smooth whiskey. I'm going to give this an 8 out of 10 on the palate.
And really if the palate was smooth, I think I would describe the finish as clean. Like it's just a nice clean finish. That's refreshing. That note of sweet honey really lingers for a long time. Mm-hmm. If there's anything disappointing about it, I would say that it doesn't last long enough. You know, I wish that there's a little bit more to the finish, but it's still a really nice finish. I'm going to move back up to a 8 out of 10 on the finish.
Yeah, this definitely has like a more minerally kind of taste that's left in your mouth afterwards. And I like that. You're right. It is a little bit shorter. The last thing that I get on my palate as it finishes is like really bitter, dark cocoa or like a cocoa powder. Brad, I'm a huge fan of this. I was not expecting to be because, you know, my general stance towards the space-eyed region. I think even if this might be a little bit of a letdown, it's still right there where all my other scores have been. I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10.
And that brings us to our overall balance. I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10 on balance. Every part of this whiskey works well together. It just lacks, I've said it before, it lacks a little bit of oomph, a little bit of chutzpah. I want it to give me a little bit more of what it's offering. So it's just not complex enough for me to give it a really high balance score, but still, you know, 7 out of 10 is solid.
Brad, I think, you know, if I've given all three of our categories so far an 8, I think that actually deserves a higher score than an 8 on balance because it has been such a consistently good experience for me. I'm going to give it an 8.5 on balance, and that takes us to our value score. Now, I will fully admit, Brad, I have not yet looked up the price on this in the state of Ohio. How much is a Macallan 12 double cask?
Yeah, Bob, in the state of Ohio, you can get a bottle of the Macallan Double Cask 12-Year for $69.99.
All right, so we're talking $70. I actually think that is the exact same price as the Aberlour 16. Brad, the more I look back on those Aberlours, and I really want to like them because the people that we worked with to get those samples were so great, I just was kind of underwhelmed with both of them at 16 and 18 years, respectively. And this one at 12 years, is much more of a flavor explosion than those other two were at higher age statements. Now, I don't think this one is as complex, but I enjoy this more. Like, it's, I really do feel like it's more bang for your buck than the Aberlour 16 or 18. Again, I am always going to be comparing things to our favorite, you know, Glenmorangie Quinta Rubin, which is only $57 in the state of Ohio. And that is a Highland Scotch. It's not a Speyside Scotch. But what I'm saying is, if I can get something I like better for $13 less, I think that is going to be kind of a ding here. I'm only going to give this one a 6.5 out of 10 on value.
Yeah, I think I'm going to give it a 6 out of 10. You know, anytime you're paying $70 for a whiskey, it better be really up there. And for me, the Aberlour is. I really love that Aberlour 16 and 18. But this one, I would say, is really good overall, just is missing a little bit on the delivery. So, you know, I'll give it a 6 out of 10. And that brings me to a 36.5 out of 50, which is actually a little bit higher than I thought I was going to end up at.
Yeah, I'm coming out to a 39 out of 50, which is actually a little lower than I thought that I would come out. But that value score really did kind of take it down just a couple notches. That's bringing us to an average of a 75.5 out of 100. Or a 37.75 out of 50. That, Brad, this is over that 35 mark where we usually recommend trying / buying. I actually think this is definitely worth picking up. Like, go to your liquor store, try it. This is probably my favorite Speyside we've had on the podcast so far. If you see it on the shelf at a whiskey bar, it's definitely worth trying there as well. Brad, what would your recommendation be?
Yeah, go grab a bottle. This is a really nice, impressive scotch that this might sound crazy for a $70 bottle of whiskey, but this is honestly a really great beginner's scotch. Mm-hmm. Like, for people who are afraid of Laphroaig, this is a great way to get them into the world of scotch.
All right, Brad. Man, what a nice, pleasant experience this was. Let's get back into arguing about the movie Malcolm X.
Yeah, you're on, man. Bring it.
All right, that was the Macallan Double Cask 12-year. We're getting back into talking about Malcolm X. And Brad, I've been told that you have a Brad G. Award to give out.
This is actually going to be like a Jeopardy session, Bob. I'm going to give you the title of the award, and you have to tell me who in the movie wins the award.
Who's the recipient? All right,
let's
do it.
There is a right answer.
Okay.
The award is titled, Why the Hell Is He in This Movie?
Why the hell is he in this movie? There's a couple people that I think it might go to. I'm going to go with Peter Boyle as the police officer who's outside the hospital at one point.
Ding, 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 ding. You are the winner. Hey. What the heck is Frank Barone doing in this movie? He is an actor who has made so much money, deservedly so, for being a character who's just ridiculous in everything that he plays. And so to choose him to be the one that delivers one of the worst, like, most obvious lines of the movie, I literally hated every second of him being in this movie.
This is a hot take.
And the problem is, I freaking love Peter Boyle. He is one of my hands-down favorite, like, one-note actors of all time. But he should not be in this movie, and he should not be the one saying, that's way too much power for one man to have.
Brad, that's a real thing that was said, though. That's in the books about Malcolm X.
I am okay with the line, but it's the person they chose to deliver it.
That's
there's
fair.
There's no sense of, like, actual awe and honor and respect of, like, man, like, that is way too much power for one man to have.
Do you know what it reminds me of? One of the movies about Jesus from like the 50s and 60s.
Oh, boy.
It might be the greatest story ever told. I don't remember which one it is, but they got John Wayne to come in and play the Roman centurion. That's
yes.
Like, have you seen this though? Like,
no, I
Jesus
haven't.
Dies on the cross, and then they cut to John Wayne, and he's just standing there like John Wayne, and he just goes, "Surely this man was the Son of God." And that's his whole contribution to the movie. And I'm like, what are you doing to the pages of scripture? Like, it's awful.
Yeah. And that's exactly how I felt about Peter Boyle in this movie. If I had to retroactively give this award out, I think that we kind of gave it out without officially giving it out for Interstellar with Matt Damon.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, we should probably do a whole episode of why the hell are they in this movie and just hand out the awards like candy.
Oh, man, I can't wait. Let's do it.
But as much as we could talk about Peter Boyle and his immaculately perfect contribution to the film Malcolm X, Bob, I feel like I'm just so cool on this movie. I'm curious, like, give me your pitch. Talk to me about Spike Lee and his direction in this film and why I should be higher on this movie than I am.
That's a good question, Brad. And I think that a lot of it is just kind of like it either works for you or it doesn't. You know, like, you think the movie's way too long. I can see that. I just think that Spike Lee does such a good job of balancing the pace that it worked for me. But there are some things that I'm like, man, I wish I could talk to you about all these references that he's sticking into the movie. Different shots, different lines, motions that the camera is making that are direct references to Spike, like things in Spike Lee's memory. And if Spike and Scorsese have one thing in common, it is that they are both walking encyclopedias of movies. Spike Lee teaches film at NYU. Like, he knows what he's doing. And, you know, even at the end of the movie, it has this weird kind of tacked on ending that is very similar to the ending of Schindler's List, even though it did it a year before Schindler's List did it, where it kind of flashes forward into the future, and we're not really talking about the 1960s anymore. It flashes forward into South Africa in 1992, where apartheid was just ending. And you have all of these, like, school children in Africa standing up and directly addressing the camera, "I am Malcolm X, I am Malcolm X." And, like, it is a very on-the-nose choice for him to make, right? But it's also like, oh, this is Spike Lee appropriating one of the most famous scenes in movie history from the movie Spartacus, where everyone stands up and says, "I am Spartacus, I'm Spartacus." But it has such a deeper, more profound meaning to these people who have literally been fighting oppression to honor Malcolm X that way. And the thing that I love about what Spike does in this movie is that I will be the first to admit that when Spike Lee indulges all of his kind of wildest tendencies, his movies are a mess. He made a movie about 5 years ago called Chi-Raq, which I thought was awful. And even this movie that came out this past year, The Five Bloods, it was a mess. There was greatness in it, but it was a mess. And what I really love in some ways is watching him kind of restrain himself. It's like the same argument I made for Django Unchained and Tarantino. You know, the opening credits of this movie, Brad, are interspersed with footage from the Rodney King beating, which happened in L.A. a year before this movie comes out. And a Spike Lee who was looking to be more confrontational would have put that in the movie. It's in the body of the movie somewhere, even if it completely took the audience out of the narrative he was trying to tell. And I loved that he kept it contained to the opening credits because it got his message across, which was like, this is still happening right now in America. But he didn't undermine the core body of the movie to do it, which is something that Spike Lee does, you know, in his worst moments, I think. So I think for me, just watching this movie, having seen as many Spike Lee movies as I have, it's just a joy to watch him work kind of inside this genre of biopic and still get his little, like, Spike Lee-isms in there, but to know when to do it and when to kind of restrain himself. So, yeah, I mean, I guess I'm just falling back on my, like, Tarantino argument from Django. It's the same argument. Like, do you want the Tarantino that made Pulp Fiction, or do you want the Tarantino that made Django? And I think that the Tarantino that made Django was a much more mature, well-rounded filmmaker. And it's the same question with Spike. Like, do you want the kind of, like, grittier, more in-your-face Spike of Do the Right Thing, or do you want the kind of more polished, argument that he's presenting here in Malcolm X.
Do the right thing all the way. I don't know if this might be one of my wildest takes, because I'm almost surprising myself with it. But it was the end of this movie where I enjoyed Spike Lee the most. Like, I don't know. It almost feels like the end of the film, you can feel Spike Lee's editorial slant through the cinematography, through the message. And that was the part of the movie where I'm like, all right, like, okay, like Spike Lee is actually saying something about this man. And that's when I was really drawn in by what Spike was doing. And so for me, the rest of the movie, especially the part where he's the puppet of Nation of Islam, that part of the movie feels so passive and restrained. I just struggle with it, and I want Spike to give me what he thinks about what's going on. And you don't get that until the very end of the film. And at that point, I just don't feel like it has a deep enough of an impact. And I think it's interesting that you've brought up The Aviator a few times, because for me, like, I've completely forgotten that that was a biopic. And I think it's because he does such a masterful job, Scorsese, that is, of, in The Aviator, he weaves this beautiful story together with the facts of the story from real life. Whereas in this movie, I feel like at the start of the film, Lee is telling a really beautiful story about this young man and his struggle with drugs. And then it just becomes, like I said, very passive. And there's nothing really, there's no impetus to the middle part of the movie. And at the end of the film, he's like, and this is what I think about Malcolm X and the power and the impact that he had. I'm back on board. But he lost me for so much of it in the middle of the film that I felt kind of blasé about the film altogether.
All right, Brad, well, before we give our final scores, I do want to touch on one more thing in this movie, and that is the treatment of faith in this movie. Like, the idea of religion is running all throughout the movie, and for good reason. And watching this movie, even as a Christian who went to seminary, right, I appreciated so much that this movie took Malcolm X's conversion seriously, that it dealt seriously with the questions of faith, with the questions of doubt, that even when Malcolm X goes through his kind of, you know, to use the hot buzzword, like the deconstruction of his faith, when he says that his faith has been shattered, and then he goes and makes the pilgrimage, he makes the Hajj to Mecca, it takes that seriously. And it never seems to condemn Islam as a faith simply because there were people in Malcolm X's life who were misusing and misappropriating it. And I honestly, like, I just feel like it is worthy of being called out. I like it when movies take faith seriously and take the people who believe in these things seriously and don't just dismiss them out of hand.
Yeah, I mean, that feels like such a rarity, especially in today's Hollywood, that a movie would actually take faith seriously in any way. And, you know, I think that's partially just reflective of the fact that America as a whole takes faith so much less seriously than it used to. But the fact that Spike Lee is willing to sit down and say, all right, this man's conversion, whether or not you believe in Islam, was legitimate to him, and we are going to view it as legitimate because he is the subject of our biopic.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is such a bold and worthwhile choice that Spike makes, that allows you to believe in his message at the end of the film.
Yeah.
That when he, as you said, he deconstructs his faith, working through the illusions that Elijah Muhammad and Baines kind of cast over him, and he kind of comes to the light, he doesn't abandon his faith. He just tries to align it more closely with what the faith truly is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a lesson that a person of any faith background should learn, is that humans are fallible. And whenever I think one of the things that bothered me most about this movie, and he, you know, he calls it out himself at the end of the film, but the fact that he just continually said the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches. And by the end of the film, I'm just like, God bless it, man. Stop relying on this dude and start preaching what actually is in the Quran and what Allah has taught you.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the end of the film, that is a huge payoff of like, yes, he finally realizes that. So yeah, I think that its treatment of faith is huge and important and something that really should be studied in the world of cinema.
Yeah, totally agree. And Brad, I'll give my final score. I honestly, every time I'm watching this movie, am esteeming it higher and higher. I really think this should be seen on the level of other kind of, you know, huge epic biopic type movies in the American cinema landscape. I think what Spike Lee is doing here is probably his best work ever as a director. Like, even just if you go back to the very first shot of the movie where it's in Chicago and it's the shot of the L train that then goes under the bridge, across the street, into a barbershop. He's doing things here that he just wasn't doing before and honestly hasn't done enough since. This movie is a 10 out of 10, and I sincerely hope that I can inspire somebody to go watch this movie because it is like a film studies 101 course in how to make a movie.
Bob, I just want to say to you that IMDb has Malcolm X rated as a 7.7 out of 10 and Bohemian Rhapsody as a 7.9 out of 10.
Yeah. Yeah.
So according to the American public, these are pretty much the same movie. And that is what the true American epic biopic is all about.
That's
it's about
America
people
for you.
Like Freddie Mercury and Malcolm X.
Yeah. Freddie Mercury, that famous American.
Yes. Yeah. That famous. Oh, man. Honestly, Bob, for me, I'm coming out to a 7.5 out of 10.
Uh-huh.
I just think that there was so much room for growth in the middle of the film that wasn't there. I don't know. I've said it a million times. I'm going to stop talking about it. It's a 7.5 out of 10. I think it is a really solid biopic that takes a lot of things very seriously. But overall, I just wasn't captivated by this film in the way that you were.
Oh, I'm kind of bummed about that. But you know what? At the end of the day, Brad, what I love about this podcast is that you give these things a try. And it sounds like you took the movie seriously. You weren't flipping about it at all. And you're just coming out to a 7.5. And I respect that. I do want to hear what Film and Whiskey Nation thinks of this movie. Have you seen Malcolm X? Are you inspired to go watch Malcolm X by what you heard today? Let us know. You can find us on all the social medias, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, @FilmWhiskey.
Or you can leave us a voicemail. Let your voice be heard on the Film and Whiskey podcast. You can do that on our website, which is anchor.fm/filmwhiskey.
Next week, we'll be back with a movie that I am just going to out myself now, Brad, is maybe one of my 10 favorite films of all time. We are taking a hard turn into the 1940s musical, and we're going to be looking at the Vincent Minnelli classic, Meet Me in St. Louis. We'll see you next Monday for that. Until then, I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
And we'll see you next time.